got this really cool piece of technology here. Look at that. All right, so before we begin, I don't take lightly the Word of God. I really think it's an honor to come before you guys, open it up, study it, discuss it, learn about it, and ultimately, I feel like be the mouthpiece of God. I take it as a very, very serious thing, and so I did just want to say thank you. Thank you a lot for allowing me to preach this morning. It means a whole lot. As Craig said, we've been going through Psalms 120 through 120 or 134. These are the Psalms of Ascent. So they're sort of like a backpacking group of psalms that the Israelites would sing on their journeys to Jerusalem. They travel in groups and they'd go up to Jerusalem and sing these songs together as they're journeying. And they ascended to Jerusalem while they did that. And so they sang these psalms. We talked about Psalm 120 and the fact that we need to reject the lies that the world may give us and reject basically those who hate peace. We talked about 121 and how God is the ultimate keeper. And so we need to accept that God is the ultimate keeper of our lives and God's and other gods just won't suffice. And then we talked about 122, that it's really good to gather together as a group of believers, encourage each other, and sharpen one another. So Psalm 121 through 120 through 122 is kind of like the foundation, right? We need to reject the world, we need to accept God, and we need to live together and encourage each other. That's like the foundation sort of principles of Christianity and Christian living. So now we move on to Psalm 123, which is a psalm that's written assuming that, you know, you've made this choice, that you have gotten to a place in your life where you're saying, okay, God, I'm going to live for you. And this is starting to talk more about what that's going to look like. What is a Christian life going to look like? What is it going to look like when we're seeking after God? Before we get too far into it, I want to talk a little bit about this painting. So this painting is called Several Circles. It's by a painter named Kandinsky. Kandinsky wrote, you might want to turn the lights down a little bit. He painted with jazz music in the background, and he sort of had this spiritual overtone in his paintings. But what I want you to notice is, where do your eyes go in this painting, right? Naturally, where do your eyes go? I feel like most of us would say our eyes sort of center in onto that black circle that's right in the top leftish center of the painting. That's the focal point of the painting. So good art typically has a focal point. And so our eyes naturally draw. We can get distracted by all these other things, but our eyes are naturally drawn into this centerpiece. That's what this psalm is saying we should do. That's what this psalm is doing for us. There's a focal point of this psalm, and there's all this other stuff happening around in the psalm, but ultimately our eyes are being drawn to something. Before we start unpacking the psalm itself, I'm just going to read the psalm out loud, and I'm going to have you guys follow along as I read out loud. So we're going to be in Psalm 123 again. So Psalm 123, and I titled it Focusing Our Eyes on the King. To you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. Behold, as the eyes of servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maidservant to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God, till he has mercy upon us. Have mercy upon us, O Lord, have mercy upon us, for we have had more than enough of contempt. Our soul has had more than enough of the scorn of those who are at ease, of the contempt of the proud. So the psalmist is painting a picture. He's using three characters to paint this picture. And what he's doing is he's showing a group of people intensely focused on the king, the one enthroned in heaven, despite the circumstances around him. And so if I were to summarize what the psalm is saying, if you like blank out and forget everything else today and don't understand the pictures and the metaphors and the illustrations, if you forget everything else, this is what the psalm wants you to think about and walk away knowing, right? Regardless of our circumstances, we should look to the king. That is the point of this psalm that we're going to be driving at. And I'm going to use different illustrations and stuff. And the psalmist uses three different characters to get to this point. And he doesn't actually use logical arguments or philosophical arguments or theological arguments. Those truths are presented, but he does so in sort of an illustrative way. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go over these three different characters, and we're going to try and understand the picture that the psalmist is painting. Then we're going to insert ourselves into that picture. I want you to find yourself somewhere in this picture that the psalmist is painting. And I think that'll become apparent as we go through the morning. So the first character in this picture we find in verse 1. What do you know, right? So to you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. We see that the focus of the picture is right here. O you who are enthroned in the heavens. Now another way to say the person who is enthroned in the heavens is to say the king. The king is the focus of the picture. So if you have your outline, you can see that there's like these three circles, and the center one is the king. The king is the center of the picture that the psalmist is trying to paint for us. If we think about the different psalms that we've gone through before, Psalm 121 is sort of reminiscent of this, right? To you I lift my eyes up is how both psalms start. However, in Psalm 120, so it's to you I lift up my eyes. And in Psalm 121:1, to you I lift my eyes to the mountains, not to the one enthroned in heaven. Psalm 121 is sort of like a little confused. The psalmist isn't really sure. He even asked the question, where does my help come from? We probably know this psalm a lot better than Psalm 123. And it's asking, you know, does my help come from the mountains? Maybe God might fall asleep. Is the sun going to hurt me? Is the moon going to hurt me? What's going on? And he's a little like on the fence about how to think about things. By Psalm 123, we're sure where our focus should be. We're sure about the focal point. And so the psalmist wants us to understand that we are lifting our eyes up to the one who is enthroned in heaven, to the king. We are sure that our king is enthroned on the heaven, that we're looking to him. So let's try and unpack who this king is that we're looking at. In the New Testament, there's a very similar verse. It's in Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12:12 reads this. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now I want you to notice this. Fixing our eyes on Jesus at the right hand of the throne of God. That is extremely similar to the opening lines of Psalm 123. To you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. We start to understand that the one who is enthroned in the heavens is Jesus. Jesus is the king that is being described in this psalm, the one who is enthroned in the heavens. The Israelites may not have understood that at this point. But fixing our eyes on Jesus, who is sitting at the right hand of the throne of God. He is the one who is enthroned in heaven. He is the king of the universe. He is the one who created everything. And so we start to gain perspective. Jesus actually lived a real human life. He understood what we were like. He understood the issues that humans deal with, and he suffered greatly. In fact, he endured the cross. So he suffered for us. He's a king that is on our level, and he's a relatable king. But he's not just a relatable king. In Colossians, we read a little bit more about who this king is, right? He's a very, very intense king. Check this out. For by him, by Jesus, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the gravity of the universe. He is all-encompassing, all-creating, all-powerful. This is the king that we're focusing on. This is the king the psalmist wants us to understand that we're focusing on. And I think it's a very, very comforting thing for me. We're not looking to somewhere else for our comfort. We're not looking to some other king. It's very easy in our lives to put something on the throne of our lives. In fact, I would even say that all of us do that, right? Whether it's money, whether it's family, whether it's a job or intelligence or power, we put something on the throne of our lives. We live our life focused on one particular thing, and that's the goal of our lives. the psalmist is saying the reason why we should focus on the king, why that should be the focus of our lives, is because he's enthroned in heaven. He is the all-encompassing God, creator of everything. He understands. Now, to illustrate this, I'm going to put a picture up here. This may stress some people out. Yeah, nothing happened in the back. Don't worry, right? No. So this is probably something that, maybe not this exact scenario, but the green screen with all these boxes coming up, air boxes, is indicative of a virus. If we have a virus on our computer, typically what we're going to do, unless we're sure we can fix it, but even then we don't know sometimes, is we're going to call someone. We're going to look to, you know, an IT guy, maybe a system administrator if it's in a business. Maybe your son or daughter knows computers really well. Maybe you think you do. Maybe you have some friends. Who knows? You're going to call someone. You're going to be like, oh, my gosh, something needs to be done. Maybe you, like, I don't know, we all have, like, that friend who's the computer guy, who's like, you know. But maybe we're going to call on them, and maybe they'll be able to fix it. They're not going to know exactly your system or exactly your setup, your computer hardware and all that might be the issue. But what if I told you that you had direct access to the person who designed all the software, wrote all the code for it? Not only that, he put the computer together by himself, so he knows all of the different hardware, actual components of your computer. He understands your computer completely. He understands all the software in your completely. He would see this and know exactly what to do in a split second. He knows exactly the issues because he built it, he programmed it, and he understands exactly the best way to fix it. That is exactly what our king is like. Our king understands our life completely. He lived as a human. He died as a human. He suffered for us. He's enthroned in heaven. He created all things, and he wants to help us. Focusing on the king gives us perspective. Life can be very tough, and that is an understatement, and I get it. And Jesus gets it too. The king understands that, and he wants to help us. He wants to provide and protect his children. The king, when we focus on the king, that's the perspective that we start to get. And that is why it's so important that the psalmist begins there. The psalmist wants us to see in that first line that we are focusing in on the king. Now, around the king, there's our second character, and we read about the second character in the second verse of the psalm. So it reads, "Behold, as the eyes of servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maidservant to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God till he has mercy upon us." So I think what this is saying is that there might be servants around the king. The psalmist wants us to see servants around the king. Now, there's some important things about these servants that we're going to be dissecting and thinking about. There is the posture of the servants, and so sort of how they look, how their body is, and then where they're actually looking. So their eyes and their posture are two very important parts of what the servants are. Now, if I were to summarize kind of the image that he wants us to get, it would be this. Around the king are helpless and faith-filled servants looking to him, looking to the king. And I use helpless and faith-filled very particularly. There's this guy... servants and masters and maidservants and mistresses in back in the day were helpless without their master. If you didn't have something, you had to go to your master to get it. If you didn't have food, shelter, if you wanted to stay with your family even, you were reliant on your master. You were totally helpless in life without your master. Your master was incredibly important to your well-being. And if you had a good master, then you were faith-filled, knowing that they would be good to you, that you could rely on them, that he is trustworthy. So being helpless and faith-filled are both very important things for a servant. And so I didn't just come up with a helpless and faith-filled thing on my own. There's this guy named O. Halsby, and he wrote a very, very important book on prayer in 1931. It's very, very just dense. It's very short. But he basically came to the conclusion in his book that if you aren't helpless and you aren't faith-filled, your prayers are useless. And with that was a pretty intense statement. But I think it gets to a truth that we're seeing here. Faith-filled and helplessness are incredibly important to our posture, to the posture of servants, incredibly important to our looking to the King. Helplessness. What is helplessness? Well, it's pretty simple, really. It's understanding that we can do nothing on our own, that we are totally helpless without someone or something to help us with it. We are helpless, so we need help, right? There is only one plan. It's plan A. It's not of us, and there is no plan B. We are totally reliant on someone else. What is faith-filled really mean? Faith is one of those Christian words that we don't often think about the, you know, direct meaning. And so I came up with sort of a simple definition of it. There's a lot to be said about faith, but if I were to say one thing simply, it would be completely hopeful or trusting. So faith is completely hopeful or trusting. And so these servants need to be helpless, and they need to be completely hopeful or trusting. They work together in unison. They're saying, okay, I can't do this alone. I'm overwhelmed. I'm overworked. I'm burdened up to my nose, and I can't do this. I'm helpless. But then they say, I know I'm completely and totally trusting that the King has got my back. He knows exactly what I need, and he's got me. So both these things work in unison, and they're the posture of the servants. Now, the other thing to note is both of them are important. If you're helpless, but you're not faith-filled, you end up asking, is God even good? You become overwhelmed with the cares of this world and the burdens of life, and you say, I can't do this. I have no confidence that God is going to come through on what he said he's going to come through on. I don't trust that God is who he says he is. I don't think that God is even good. Is God even good? And so if you're helpless, you become depressed, essentially. And you become, you start asking, is God good? Now, if you're faith-filled and not helpless, then you start to ask, do I need God? Because if you're not helpless, you start to put your faith in the wrong things, like yourself. You can become arrogant. You start to put your faith in things other than God, and you start to say, well, I can trust in money. I can trust in the mountains, as it were in Psalm 121. I can trust in other things other than God. And ultimately, if it doesn't happen in this life, that is going to collapse on itself because it's not true. Our ultimate hope isn't in anything but God. And so if we're not helpless, we start to ask, do I even need God? So both of these postures create a balance within us. The servants are faith-filled and helpless. And this is where we should start inserting ourselves into this picture. Now, the second thing to notice about the servants is their eyes. In Psalm 123:1, he says, I lift up my eyes to you, or you who are enthroned in heavens. And then he continues, right? Behold, as the eyes of the servants look to the hand of their master, and as the eyes of a maidservant, and then there's an implicit look to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God till he has mercy upon us. Eyes, 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 right? He really wants us to notice these eyes. And this is going to be kind of fun. This is what I imagine it sort of being like. You know, in poetry, they really want us to think about these things. So, to you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in heaven. Behold, as the eyes of a maidservant look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maidservant look to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God till he has mercy upon us. Sort of flashing these eyes before us. Wham, 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 our eyes. And so what we're starting to realize is where these eyes are looking to are very important. You've probably often heard that, you know, maybe eyes are the portal to the soul. If you stare at someone in the eyes long enough, it can become a little bit awkward, maybe if you don't know them too well. Like there's something really powerful about our eyes. Where we focus our intention, it really matters. And the psalmist recognizes this. However many thousands of years ago, eyes are really important. Where you look at, where you pay your attention to really matters. And we're going to see even more so why, but right now it's suffice to say that the psalmist wants us to understand that the servants are helpless, that they're totally hopeful in Christ or in God, and that they are looking directly at the King. Now, I don't know how theologically accurate this illustration is going to be, but I kind of imagine it like the citizens of Metropolis. In The Adventures of Superman in 1952, there's this phrase that comes out, right? It's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's Superman, and everyone looks up into the sky. You know, there's this asteroid coming out of this outer space, and it's about to land on the city, and the citizens are like, well, all I know, hope and love is about to be destroyed. They're totally helpless, right? They can't do anything about this. They are going to be crushed. But they see Superman, and they have a history with him. They know what he's capable of. They're like, he can do it. Superman can do this. I have total confidence that Superman has all the capability and all the power that he needs in order to save us. And so what do they actually do? They actually look to him. They look directly, fix their gaze on Superman. And so I think this is a pretty good illustration, like that we can be the citizens of Metropolis and that Superman is kind of like Jesus. Is that super cliche? Maybe, but still, it's so awesome, right? We are totally helpless without him. We are totally trusting in his power entirely, and we are fixing our eyes and our gaze on him, just like the citizens of Metropolis. So we see the king in the center of this picture that the psalmist is painting, and we see the servants around the king, gazing at the king, looking to him, totally helpless, but totally hopeful that he is able to do all that he needs to do. Now, this is a pretty picture so far, right? It seems actually fairly easy and simple. It doesn't seem a lot like real life, right? There's the king, there's servants, and we're looking to him, and it's great. Like, okay, right? We ended there, easy sermon, easy talk, and easy life. But that's not actually what life is like, is it? And so we end up getting this third character in this picture. And we read about it in verses 3 and 4. The servants are actually in distress, and so they're crying out to the king that they're looking at totally helplessly and totally hopefully. They're looking to him. And so if we continue on, in verses 3 and 4, we read, "Have mercy upon us, O Lord, have mercy upon us, for we have had more than enough of contempt. Our soul has had more than enough of the scorn of those who are at ease, of the contempt of the proud." Scorn and contempt are a little bit strange words. They're great translations, but I don't know how often I use those two words in, you know, everyday language. So if we think about scorn, like mocking, that would be a pretty close thing. It's like more intense mocking. That's what scorn is. And contempt is sort of like disrespect. And so there's this disrespectful, mocking group of people that are around the servants. They're mocking them. They're scorning them. They're disrespecting them. They're full of contempt. And so around the servants would be this final character, the mockers. They're around the servants, pressuring them, trying to pull away their gaze. The servants are looking to the king, and the mockers are looking around. You're not good enough. You shouldn't be looking at the king. He's stupid. You know, he can't do anything for you. Look at this. Live this way. Don't live your way. Trying to distract them. So we have the mockers looking at the servants, trying to pull their attention away from the king, and then the servants looking to the king, and the king at the center as the creator God of the whole entire universe. So while the servants call out to God, they are scorned. And I think that it's important to remember in all of this that this is a backpacking psalm, right? So if you think about the Psalms of Ascent, this is all in the context of a journey to Jerusalem. They're singing Psalm 120, 121, 122, and on. Maybe not in order, but maybe, who knows. They're just walking along with their groups, with their buds, and they're singing these psalms, right? And so, "Have mercy upon us" is repeated twice there. It's the word hanenu. And then, "O Lord" is a fairly common word, Yahweh. You've probably heard that before. This one is a little bit more... It's a little bit more complicated. It's ki ra'av savanu vuz in Hebrew. And so if we put it all together and you'll allow me to try and sing, maybe we can kind of like pull ourselves back into what it might have sounded like, right? So without further ado, right? Hanenu Yahweh hanenu ki ra'av savanu vuz. Hanenu Yahweh, hanenu. Kira'av Savanuvus. So they'd be marching along to Jerusalem. They'd be singing this song together. They'd be singing a lot of different songs together, but this would be something that they're saying, and they're reminding themselves, God, God, have mercy on us. We are surrounded by these people. We're trying to live our life for you. We're trying to be a set-apart people as you've called us to be. And there's all these people around us pulling for our attention. We are just full of contempt. We have been full of contempt. We've had our share. Like, help us, Lord. And I think it's important to understand that they have had a lot of contempt. We read all kinds of stories in the Bible, and one such story is found in Nehemiah 4. And so Nehemiah, he is leading a group of Israelites back to Jerusalem, and on their way, the other locals, not the Israelites, the ones that have been there for a while they were in captivity, they've sort of made their home there. And the Israelites get there, and the other people, they're kind of upset that they're there. They're rebuilding their wall, they're rebuilding their city, and the other people around the Israelites are giving them a really hard time. So you don't have to turn to Nehemiah 4. I'll read it out loud. You can follow along. But basically what happens is a group of people start mocking them. Really, they get angry at the Israelites. So Nehemiah 4 reads, "Now when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and the army of Samaria, 'What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that?' Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, 'Yes, what are they building? If a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall.'" So you kind of get this idea, like, there's people around the Jews that are saying, you're not going to do this. You're trusting in someone that shouldn't be trusted in. And besides, there's no possible way that you can even use burned stones. Even a fox is going to knock down your wall. And you see the contemptuous, scorning people all around the Israelites. We shouldn't be surprised that as Christians today, we face this as well. Jesus warned us that we would. In John 15, 18 through 20, this is what he says in relation to scorners and mockers and really the world just hating Christians. "If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of this world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will also keep yours." And so we as Christians should not be surprised when we are faced with the scorn and the mocking and the ridicule of the world, because we're trying to live a different way. If we cry out, "Have mercy upon us, Lord, have mercy upon us," I don't think that that is out of place. Maybe you've experienced some sort of scorn or mocking. Maybe at your place of work, people know that you're a Christian and you live a certain way and they say it's stupid. Maybe there's a neighbor who's a little bit further along in life than you, who has more than you, who is a little bit wealthier, and they don't go to church. They didn't need God's help. Why? What are you doing? You're doing life wrong. You're wasting your time with all this Christian stuff. Maybe there's overtly anti-Christians in your life that actually say, like, you're doing something bad. Maybe it's not people. Maybe it's just a cultural thing, right? Jesus can't be the only way to heaven, right? Like, that seems hateful. How can you say that people are wrong? How can you, there's a lot of cultural pressure on Christians. You're not doing it right. There's a lot of disrespect and a lot of mocking thrown Christians' way. Maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's not about your beliefs, but it's just about who you are. And you're trying to live a nice, simple, healthy life. And you have all these messages all around you pressuring you. You're not good enough. You need this. You need that. You're not fast enough. You're not strong enough. Not enough people like you. You need more friends. And if you get X, Y, and Z, then you'll have more friends and you'll be stronger and you'll be better. And you're like, that's not what the Bible says, though. I thought I was supposed to live a certain way. And the thing is all these things and pressure around you are pushing in on you. And they're trying to draw your attention away from what matters. And the psalmist wants us to see that we need to focus on the King, because the King is the one that made the universe. He's the one that created everything. He invented life. He understands it. He knows your situation. He cares about you. And he knows exactly what you can and should do to have the most fulfilling life possible. But we have all these messages around us saying, hey, I think I know better. And we're able to say, no, actually you don't. Because the creator of everything has told us what to do. And he's saying something different than you're saying. I'm not going to listen to you. We're supposed to walk away with this image of the King in the center, the servants focused in on the King, and all this pressure from the scorners and mockers all around us. So let's get back to this painting. Our center circle there, the black one, our eyes are constantly drawn to it, right? There's all this distraction happening all around it, but for some reason, our eyes are continually drawn to that center circle. You know, there's a lot of different color going on, a lot of action, and a lot happening. But our eyes are constantly drawn to the center. That is what we should be doing as Christians. That's what the psalm is trying to get us to understand, that we need to constantly return our focus to the center, to the King, to God, because it's going to make us more relaxed about life. It's going to reduce worry. It's going to reduce stress, because he's got it. God's got your back. God loves you. God cares for you. He wants to take care of you. So maybe you're sitting there and you're sitting there excited to focus on God. You're saying, all right, I'm going to focus on God. And if, you know, we just ended the talk right now, you guys might leave excited and then not doing anything, right? So I'm going to just try and apply this to your guys' life. Now, it's very, very important that we don't, that I don't know about you, but if I ever try and do too much, I get overwhelmed and I burn out really fast. So I'm going to put a list up on this board. Don't get overwhelmed by it. Don't read all of them and thinking you need to do everything. This is just a bunch of different suggestions to get you thinking, okay? How do I focus on God this week? Ask yourself that when you're reading this list. How do I focus more on God this week, okay? So here's a list of disciplines. They're all biblical disciplines. They're from a book called Celebration of Discipline. And there's inward disciplines, outward disciplines, and corporate disciplines, things that you do together. Think of something on this list. If anything pops out to you that maybe you could do this week, just one thing, just do one thing a little bit better and a step in the right direction to focus on God more. If nothing is like jumping out at you, I would suggest prayer. So prayer is something that is incredibly important to the Christian walk. If you don't pray, if you pray a little, or if you pray a lot, there's always room to pray more. Prayer is a critical part of the Christian life that helps us focus on God more. So prayer is a really, really good one. I don't want you to just default to it. If something is standing out to you, maybe simplicity. Maybe you need to reduce some clutter in your life, and that'll help you focus on God more. Maybe confession. Maybe there's a sin that's just eating away at you, and you just need to confess it. And once it's removed, that is going to be allowing you to focus on God more. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a minute or two of total silence. It's going to feel a little strange, maybe to some of you, but I want you to either reread the Psalm, Psalm 123, look at this list, and I want you to just ask God, what can I do this week to focus on you? Just baby steps. Baby steps lead into 52 weeks of intentionally focusing on God. Just take a little step. What can you do this week? And after the service is done, maybe talking with someone about the sermon afterward, tell someone. Tell someone what you're doing so they can hold you accountable to it. It's kind of an intense step, I know, but it might hold you accountable. So I'm going to give you a little bit of time to think that, and then afterward, we're going to close with some songs. Oh, you know what? I'm so sorry. I need to pray. I just talked about how important prayer is. Father God, I just lift up to you, all these people here in this room, and myself included. Thank you so much for your word and for your encouragement in your word, that we can focus on you, that we can trust you, and that no matter what is going on in our life, you understand it. You've created life, and you can provide everything we need. We are able to focus on you, knowing that you are loving, caring, and able to help us. So God, this week, I pray you can highlight something in our lives where we're able to just focus on you more. And I pray that you might enter into this space right now and just reveal that to us, what it might be. In your name, I pray. Amen.